Hello, here is your KVNF regional newscast for Wednesday, March 7th. The State House of Representatives recently took a historic vote to expel a legislator. The vote came after an independent report found five women credible who had accused Representative Steve Lebsack of sexual harassment. The night before the vote, it did not appear that he would be expelled. Benta Berkland talks to State House reporters about the drama, what's next, and what it means for some of the pending investigations in the state Senate, and the mixed message it's sending.
I'm joined by Marianne Goodland with Colorado Politics and Brian Eason with the Denver Post. A dramatic day on Friday, and a lot of times when we're in the Capitol, the outcome is predetermined. People know how they're going to vote going into a debate, a bill hearing. A lot of people thought that this expulsion vote would fail. What do you think made the difference, Marianne?
I think the mood in the House really began to change when Assistant Minority Leader Cole Wist of Centennial got up and said that while he had an open mind, and he would continue to have an open mind on the issue, he viewed a 28-page manifesto that Representative Lebsack put out as retaliation, and that's a really clear-cut violation of the Capitol's sexual harassment policy.
On the eve of the vote, Republicans had a host of concerns on the process, the redacted report. Some didn't trust the investigator or the investigation.
Yeah, absolutely. You had a number of folks telling us that there was no way they were going to vote for it. There were a number of people who were leaning no, and that's why Representative Wist's comments on retaliation were so important, because it opened up a path for Republicans who still had issues with the process, still had issues with the investigations. You saw the Senate president in the other chamber questioning investigations in his own chamber. And so when Representative Wist brought up retaliation, that was something that all the lawmakers could decide for themselves whether it had occurred rather than relying on this investigation.
The Senate president has said this vote doesn't change how he's handling things. There's three lawmakers there who've been investigated for workplace harassment. The accusers have been found to be credible. There are two pending investigations still against Senator Randy Baumgartner. Those are Republican members. And the Senate president, Brian, has said that he will not move to expel someone unless they've been convicted of a crime. So a lot of stuff still happening in the Senate. How does this impact that?
It's going to be really interesting, and I don't think anyone really quite knows how it's going to impact that yet. In talking to Representative Winner, who, of course, was one of the women who brought the complaint against Representative Lebsack, she's concerned that the different handling of these complaints in the different chambers is sending mixed messages to folks. You have House Democrats saying the harassment itself was worthy of expulsion. You have House Republicans saying, well, we don't know about this investigation, but the retaliation, that's where expulsion kicks in. Then you have the Senate president saying not even retaliation, it has to be an actual crime to expel someone. And so I think there is still concern among women at the Capitol that, like, there still isn't a clear bar for punishment that folks feel like is going to get applied equally everywhere.
The one thing that we have seen in all of these cases here is questions about the process. The investigation done by the Employers Council into the allegations against Senator Tate has come back with questions raised about bias and credibility. Same thing with the investigation done by the same organization with Senator Baumgartner. The fact that now the Senate president wants this whole thing handed off to the District Attorney of Denver, who has unfortunately worked with both of these folks when she was a lawmaker, just creates a new level of complexity.
Thanks, Marianne Goodland with Colorado Politics and Brian Eason with the Denver Post, and we'll be covering this complexity as well as the new rules they're going to be coming up with later this session. I'm Benta Berkland, and this was Capitol Conversation.
Despite a booming economy, Colorado is still struggling to make sure all of its residents have access to nutritious food. Eric Gladys has this story.
A new report shows Colorado is making improvements on getting food assistance to struggling residents, but significant challenges remain. Hunger-Free Colorado's third annual food stamp impact reports measure how each of the state's 64 counties are faring when it comes to enrollment in the federal SNAP program and calculates benefits to state and local economies. Catherine Ferguson is the group's director of public policy.
Colorado is making great progress, but unfortunately, The state ranks 45th in the nation for access to food stamps. Today, just 58% of those who are eligible are getting the nutritious food that they need. The national average, by comparison, is 75%.
Ferguson says even though Colorado boasts one of the strongest economies in the nation, 1 in 10 residents struggles with hunger. The Trump administration's budget proposal would cut food stamps by 30%, and proponents claim states can save money by distributing boxes of food with items such as canned fruits and vegetables. Ferguson says that policy would actually cut benefits for most Colorado participants by almost half, and she warns that seniors living on fixed incomes could lose assistance altogether. Ferguson notes the average benefit is $1.42 per person per meal and can only be used for food.
For families who are struggling to make ends meet, that little bit of help can be the difference between choosing between medicine and food or rent and feeding your children.
According to the Public Health Institute, if all eligible Coloradans were enrolled, the state could save up to $2 billion a year on health care and other costs associated with not having regular access to nutritious food. Ferguson says food stamps are also a significant economic driver.
But they also support local businesses and the local economy. Last year, food stamps brought $728 million to local Colorado economies.
The report's recommendations include making full enrollment in food stamps a priority at the county level and reducing barriers to access by expanding office hours so families can sign up without missing work. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
And there's news from Colorado Parks and Wildlife today. First, from a press release, bird watchers are reminded that the annual spring migration of greater sandhill cranes is in full force in southern Colorado. The annual San Luis Valley Crane Festival is scheduled this year for Friday through Sunday. The large wetland areas, wildlife refuges, and grain fields in the San Luis Valley draw about 25,000 birds. The cranes stop in the valley to rest up and refuel on their way to summer breeding grounds in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. Sandhill cranes are among the oldest living species on the planet. Fossil records of cranes date back 9 million years. And second, Parks and Wildlife researchers have started a project to learn more about the brown-capped rosy finch. It may have a delicate name, but the tough little bird lives year-round in Colorado's high country. The brown-capped rosy finch is one of 107 species of greatest conservation concern in Colorado. In annual bird counts, the number of finches is down, and scientists are concerned that climate change could be affecting the finch's high-altitude habitat. And that was your KVNF regional newscast for Wednesday. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.